You are Locked On Seahawks, your daily Seattle Seahawks podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Greetings, 12s. You're listening to the Locked On Seahawks podcast. I'm your host, Corbin Smith, joined by Rob Rang. It's Throwback Tuesday. We're going to put a bow on Seattle's 40-3 blowout win over the New York Jets on Sunday by taking a peek at how the defense performed, giving up just 3 points, continuing to trend in the right direction after a rough start to the season. And of course, we're going to look back at some players that played for both the Seahawks and the Washington football franchise. This football season will be different, and Pepsi is here to get you ready for game day no matter how you watch this season. Whether you're watching from the press box like me or watching with family at home, Pepsi is a refreshment you need to power through game day and become a member of the League of Football Watchers, because Pepsi isn't made for those who play the game. It's made for those who watch it. Pepsi, made for football watching. Now for your lead story here on Locked On Seahawks. 3 games left to play in the 2020 season. Most teams are dealing with injuries at this point, significant ones at that. But Rob, the Seahawks, and we've talked about this a few times in recent weeks, they have a number of key players that have been sidelined that have a legitimate opportunity to get back now for this closing stretch run. And it starts with running back Rashad Penny and cornerback Quentin Dunbar, who both returned to practice last week. And according to Pete Carroll, they're practicing this week with the goal of being able to return to the playing field on Sunday against Washington.
Yeah, I mean, you'd be especially excited for Rashad Penny coming off of such a major knee injury. That's obviously a big story to watch. It would be a big development for him personally. It would be the shot in the arm that we've been talking about for weeks, as you mentioned, Corbin. The Seattle's running game, while they have two absolute bulldozers in Chris Carson and Carlos Hyde, they don't have that speed threat. And so to get Rashad Penny back would be able to give you a little bit more juice on the offensive side of the ball. And then on defense, Quentin Dunbar, we know what a long arm physical player that he can be for the Seahawks. You know that he's going to be really jacked up in the hopes that he's able to return to the field against his former teammates in Washington. So they're two stories that are really interesting to watch for their own, not only for the football aspect, but for the personal aspect as well.
Yeah, this has been a long road back for Rashad Penny, not being able to play at all up to this point. And everything that I've been told, and I'm not just talking about the comments from Pete Carroll and Russell Wilson in their press conferences, talking to a couple sources, he has been absolutely dynamite. And this shouldn't be surprising, because I was saying this 2 months ago that all the reports I was hearing were extremely encouraging on how good of shape he was in, how athletic he looked coming back from this injury. And so, again, he's just going to give you a different type of weapon that you don't currently have in the backfield, a guy with true home run threat ability. And as for Dunbar, I know a lot of Seahawk fans have soured on him, whether you're looking back at all the fiascos that were going on in the offseason with him being arrested and then eventually having charges dropped, and then playing in some games where it looked like the effort wasn't there. He's been dealing with a nagging knee injury, though. I think that's really what was going on against Buffalo last month, is that he just simply was not healthy enough to perform near where he needed to be. And the Seahawks just didn't feel like they had anybody else in the roster that they could plug in at that point. This is still a player that, when healthy, is one of your top two corners alongside Shaquille Griffin. You want to get him back out there, especially with the Rams game coming up next week. If you can get him a start, get him some valuable snaps to get some of that rust off him, and he's healthy, that's going to be a big deal going into week 16 in that de facto NFC West championship game. So getting both these players for different reasons is going to provide a boost for the Seahawks with 3 games left to play. And this is the other update that Pete Carroll gave yesterday that I thought was really impressive. Greg Olsen is challenging to practice this week. Now, we'll see if that actually happens or not. He's 3 weeks removed from a fascia tear in his foot. If he is able to return to practice this quickly, sounds like he's moving really well. He's very optimistic about his recovery timeline here. just a remarkable recovery. Even if he's able to only practice in limited fashion and he's still not going to be back for another week or two, the fact that we're even having this discussion, I was very skeptical about him being back for the end of the regular season. Now, it's looking like there's a really good chance the veteran's going to be back out there catching passes from Russell Wilson before we get to the playoffs.
That would be a remarkable turnaround. You're absolutely right. And it's not only because of the complication of the injury, but obviously Greg Olsen's age. I think that it just speaks to his commitment. And so when you have a player who has been around the NFL as long as Greg Olsen has, and who basically could retire right now, and anybody who has watched football in the NFL for the last 15 years or so recognizes what a difference maker he was. And you see that type of buy-in by a guy who's only been on the roster for less than a calendar year, I think it's really easy for the rest of the Seahawks to get excited about where this team could go. So to me, that's the whole point of these players who are the influences in the locker room. And that's why you sign veterans like Greg Olsen. And to me, one of the big storylines that we have to watch kind of moving forward is Seattle going to improve along the line of scrimmage on the injury front as well? Of course, Brandon Shell went down with the ankle injury. You have to be concerned about Washington's front line. Carlos Dunlap, Seattle, the terrific pass rusher for the Seahawks. He's dealing with an injury as well. Are they going to be able to get back in time for this game? It's going to be something to watch here over the next couple of days before we get to Sunday.
And Shell's injury is especially pressing because you mentioned Washington's defense, the strength of their defense is their pass rushers. First round pick Chase Young, top three pick, and then Montez Sweat the season before, the player that I still to this day don't know why Seattle did not use their first rounder on him. Obviously, LJ Collier has improved a lot this season, but Montez Sweat has been dynamic in his two seasons so far for Washington. And so you've got to have your starting right tackle for that game as well as Chad Wheeler played last week. You don't want Chad Wheeler having to try to block Chase Young, Montez Sweat, Ryan Kerrigan. So they have to hope Brandon Shell is going to be able to make it back. Pete Carroll did say that Shell told him he was not any worse than he was at this time last week. So that gives you a little hope. Maybe he can gut it out and play in this game. Carlos Dunlap didn't play at all last week, so maybe getting a weekend off is what he needed to turn the corner. So there's some optimism about those two being able to play. And Cedric Ogbuehi could be back this week as well. So that would give him a little more depth in case Brandon Shell isn't quite ready to go at right tackle. But still, Ogbuehi or Wheeler, if Jamarco Jones somehow comes back, we had no health updates on him. But any of those three players playing right tackle instead of your starter Brandon Shell, that is a big concern going into this game. So those are the injuries we are going to be watching closely over the next few days to see which one of those guys can make it back and potentially play against a red-hot Washington team that has won four straight games to climb to the top of the NFC East. Coming up next in the second quarter, it's Throwback Tuesday. We're going to look back in time at some standout players that had some strong seasons for both the Seahawks and the Washington football franchise. Don't go away. You're listening to the Locked On Seahawks podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day. This episode is brought to you by Top 10. Now, you may have read about this in the New York Times or Forbes, and we're excited to tell you about it. Top 10 is an exclusive collection of 10 one-of-a-kind engagement rings designed by 10 of the most distinctive designers working today. Using only diamonds responsibly sourced from Botswana, 10 design masters have each produced a uniquely beautiful commitment ring, launching exclusively on January 18th at BlueNile.com. And when they're gone, they're gone. We all know that the diamond engagement ring is iconic. It's a timeless expression of the deepest commitment between two people, and with Top 10, it's been beautifully re-envisioned in the hands of 10 modern designers working exclusively with sustainably sourced diamonds. If you're making 2021 plans and looking for a unique and meaningful way to celebrate Valentine's Day, you're definitely going to want to check this out. Again, this exciting limited edition collection of diamond engagement rings launches on January 18th, and you can preview it exclusively at BlueNile.com. Welcome back to the Locked On Seahawks podcast, Tuesday edition. This is your host, Corbin Smith, joined by Rob Rang. Coming up on our Wednesday episode, we're going to be diving into the matchups, and man, there's some intriguing ones going into this football game between the Seahawks and the Washington football team. So we'll look at three for the Seahawks on offense and three matchups for the Seahawks on defense going up against one of the hottest teams in the NFC. It's Throwback Tuesday. Let's look back in time a little bit. This is one of those things, it's one of our favorite segments on this show, where being history teachers, the background that we have, we really like to go back in time and look at players that had standout seasons for not just the Seahawks, but their upcoming opponent. And Seattle has not played Washington since 2017. It has been a while. Kirk Cousins was still under center when Washington and Seattle last played, and Washington actually pulled the upset at then-named CenturyLink Field. I think we have to start this conversation with Sean Springs. In my estimation, Rob, probably the best player to star for both teams when we're looking at the Seahawks and the Washington football franchise.
Yeah, I have to agree with you there, Corbin. I think that you could mention players, you know, Sean Alexander, Joey Galloway, Mike Tice, guys who stayed there for a year or so, you know. But at the same time, if we're looking at players who were played both in Seattle and in Washington and made big-time plays and were real contributors to clubs over an extended period of time, then, yeah, I think that the former first-round pick by Seattle, drafted the same year as the Hall of Famer Walter Jones, Sean Springs was a spectacular athlete for the Seahawks, a very productive player, went on to big things in Washington as well. You know, he was one of my favorite players kind of growing up. My brother and I were big fans of the game of Ohio State and Michigan. And my brother being a big Michigan fan, me being a big Ohio State fan, and just watching Sean Springs, what a dynamic athlete. So I was so excited when Seattle drafted him. I actually bought my brother a jersey. And when Sean Springs initially was drafted by Seattle, this is some of those random things that people may not remember, his number was 26. And that was the jersey I bought my brother. So he was the only Seahawks fan out there that had a Sean Springs jersey out there that said 26 before Springs turned to number 24. And that's what he played during his career with Seattle. So a spectacular talent, a guy that, you know, I always wondered if maybe he never, achieved the dominant level of play that I thought he was going to early on in his career. He looked like he was going to be one of the great ones because he had the elite athleticism, because he had great hands and a kind of a flair for the dramatic. But at the same time, he never wound up becoming the great player that, again, his draft mate Walter Jones wound up being for the Seahawks draft just a couple of picks later.
Yeah, and I don't want our listeners to get the wrong idea. Sean Springs was a very good NFL cornerback, and he made the Pro Bowl in his second season in Seattle. He had 7 interceptions that year, but that was the only Pro Bowl that he played in. And that's not to say he didn't have some other really good seasons. He had another year where he ended up picking off 5 passes as well. He had back-to-back years with at least 5 interceptions, did not make the Pro Bowl that year. And then the last few years he was with the Seahawks, he actually played 7 seasons in Seattle before leaving in free agency. He just wasn't the same player, and I've never been able to put a finger on it. He was still the same athlete, still had the same hands, but he just, for whatever reason, was not near as productive. And I don't know if the swagger was gone or the confidence just wasn't there that he had early in his career. Maybe some bad games ended up ultimately hindering him. He just didn't seem like the same player that they drafted out of Ohio State, but that did not stop Washington from giving him a massive free agent contract. And his first season with the team, he went out and got 4 interceptions for him. So that deal at the time looked like it was going to be a really smooth, really smart move for Washington. He had one other season with 4 picks for them, but those seasons were sprinkled around a handful of years where he was just an average NFL corner, and that's not what they were paying him for. So you could say Washington and Seattle maybe have some of the same gripes. You saw those seasons where he was much more dominant, and then he would have a year or two where he just kind of drifted towards mediocrity, and he was just such a great athlete and had so many ball skills that ultimately it did feel like he never quite reached his potential.
Yeah, that's the thing. You know, sometimes when you've been doing the scouting as long as I have, Corbin, you see some athletes where it just seems like the game just comes so natural to them. They're just a different level of fluidity. And that was one of the things that Springs had. And so I was always kind of waiting for him to, emerge as one of the truly elite cornerbacks in the NFL. He was one of the better cornerbacks, at least in my opinion, in Seattle Seahawks history. And I would argue with Washington as well. But I thought that he would be competing to be the best of all time for those franchises. And he was a terrific player. I mean, anytime you have an NFL cornerback who plays for 13 18 years in the NFL, having a legitimate 4.4 speed even at the very end, I think that we're talking about an elite athlete. But again, when you think about some of the great corners in Seattle's history, the Richard Shermans, the Dave Browns, and then you think of Washington with, you know, the Daryl Greens and players like that, just Sean Springs to me is that guy that is, you know, a quality player, somebody that the fans are going to remember fondly. At the same time, they're not necessarily going to put them on the Hall of Fame list. And to me, that it's kind of leads into the next player that we want to talk about. And for me, that would be Philip Daniels, a kind of a guy that a defensive end out of Georgia. He was, you know, a fourth round selection rather than being a top five pick the way that Sean Springs was kind of not necessarily expected to be a superstar from the get go. But let's talk about a guy who got every bit of production out of his body. He was an underrated pass rusher, was certainly very productive against the run. If I was going to try and compare him for fans who are Seahawks fans out there who don't remember Philip Daniels so much, I would use a little bit of a comparison. It's like an LJ Collier now, a guy that is very physical at the point of attack, is a tough guy, is a guy that, again, I think a lot of Seahawks fans who remember number 93 back in the day for Seattle, and certainly with his production in Washington as well, they remember him fondly.
And we've talked about this a few times because he was in our top 100 Seahawks countdown that we did this offseason. And this is still one of the biggest free agent mistakes that I think the Seahawks have made in the last 30 years. I mean, you could make an argument it's up there for their franchise history, because this is a player that, as you mentioned, he came in as a fourth round pick that didn't start any games as a rookie, had just two sacks. Next season, he gets four. Then his third year, he's a full-time starter, gets 6.5 sacks, has 48 tackles. Then his final year in Seattle, 1999, plays all 16 games, starts all of them, and produces 9 sacks, which ultimately tied what would be his career high. He did it one other time with the Chicago Bears a couple years later. The Seahawks let him get away in free agency, and I still to this day don't know what the Seahawks were thinking. There were a few really curious moves after Mike Holmgren's first season as coach and being involved as the general manager as well. And I think ultimately that's why he ended up just becoming the coach down the road, because there were some mistakes made that I think he regretted that ultimately might have gotten the Seahawks to the Super Bowl quicker than 2005. This was one of them that to this day, as I said, it still eats at me, because I thought Philip Daniels, you mentioned getting the most out of your talent. He had 62 sacks in his career at 6'6", 310 pounds, 3 seasons of more than 10 tackles for loss, and he was a gamer. The guy played until he was 37. He played at a high level all the way up until that final season and was a full-time starter most of his NFL career. One of the most underrated Seahawks, and unfortunately only got to see 4 seasons of him because they let him walk, and had a really long, productive career, and now is widely regarded as one of the best defensive line coaches in the NFL.
Exactly. And that's the thing, is it's easy to understand why. When you had that size, you had that power, that versatility. You know, he played in an era, of course, where teams didn't throw the football around the way that they do now. And so you had to be a full service defensive end. It couldn't just be about, getting to the quarterback and creating those sacks. But he did do a good job of that. As you mentioned, 62 sacks over his 14-year NFL career, tied his career high with 9 sacks in Seattle in 1999. Before he got signed away by Chicago, also had 9 sacks in 2001 with Chicago, but it was the 15 tackles for loss that he had in that 1999 season with the Seahawks. It was the 10 passes deflected that he had for the Bears in 2001. He was an all-around good player, and I think that's one of the reasons why he's an all-around terrific coach as well, is because, again, the proof is in the pudding. If he could do it himself, then he obviously can help teach other players how to do it as well. But again, kind of like Sean Springs, in that he did it for the long haul. And that to me is one of the things that you always remember about him, is his versatility, his toughness, and his longevity in the NFL.
Seahawks fans have to hope LJ Collier can have that kind of longevity, because you compare the two skill sets. I would have loved to see Philip Daniels playing base defensive end for Pete Carroll. He would have been a monster. You mentioned the fact that in today's game, they're throwing the ball a lot more than they did back then. Philip Daniels could have been a guy that had a few seasons with double-digit sacks. He had that kind of ability, just a really underrated all-around player. going from the base defensive end spot to the Leo position, the prototypical Leo in Pete Carroll's system, to me, is still Chris Clemens coming over in a trade. Right when Pete Carroll arrived, coming over via trade, comes in, and each of his first three seasons gets 11-plus sacks. He was one of the NFL's best, most ferocious edge rushers. His ability to get upfield, bend around the edge, he could win with power sometimes when he wanted to, had an incredible motor. And I still believe if he would not have torn his ACL, ironically, on Washington's field in the wild card round in 2012, and he was healthy, I think just his presence, the Seahawks would have beaten the Atlanta Falcons the next week, and I would not have put it past them to get to the Super Bowl in Russell Wilson's rookie season rather than 2013. He was that kind of an impact player for this defense, and ultimately, maybe his best attribute was his leadership. How many times do you hear Bruce Irvin bring up Chris Clemens? There were other young players. KJ Wright has mentioned him before. He was one of the veteran leaders that all these young guys, when that defense really started to blossom, they were learning from him. They were leaning on him and Brandon Mebane and Red Bryant, those guys that maybe weren't your superstars necessarily, but they were the leaders that really brought out the best in Wright and some of those other players when they were really young and eventually led to a Super Bowl victory.
Yeah, I love that you mentioned that the leadership ability that Clemens brought to the table, you know, just because you're absolutely right. I mean, he was kind of the alpha dog. And so to be for a trade to bring him in, for him to have that type of immediate impact, immediately justify, the move to go get him, and for him to be as productive as he was, again, a guy that not only was productive as a pass rusher, but also, you know, he had, 40 tackles for loss in his first three seasons with Seattle, those first three seasons when he didn't have the injury issues. And then in 2013, when unfortunately he was only able to start 11 of the 14 games in which he was able to play, wound up finishing his career in Jacksonville. But I think that, you know, we talked specifically about what he did in Seattle, where he was a superstar. Easily the best production of his career was in Seattle. Joined Washington as an undrafted free agent. We talked so much about how Seattle has had a great deal of success. Kudos to Washington for finding him as an undrafted free agent, kind of like Philip Daniels out of the University of Georgia as well, another Bulldog. So again, to me, this is all about a guy that the proof was in the pudding. You have a player who played hard, and that's why he was able to scratch out an NFL career in the first place. And then he was put into the perfect system that matches his skill set. He had great burst. He had great toughness. He certainly was a playmaker for the Seahawks.
Yep, he had the chip on his shoulder throughout his NFL career, and that's why he played for such a long time being an undrafted guy. And those are the kind of players that Pete Carroll is always looking for. So it shouldn't be a surprise that the Seahawks made that trade to bring him in, and it shouldn't be a surprise that in this scheme that fit his skill set perfectly that he really exploded late in his career and had those three dominant seasons rushing off the edge. It still eats at me that he never made a Pro Bowl because he was one of the best pass rushers in the NFL from 2010 to 2012 and really shined in Pete Carroll's scheme. When we come back for the third quarter, coming back to the present, we're going to wrap up our analysis of Seattle's 40-3 beatdown of the Jets. We looked at offense yesterday. We're going to swing over to the defensive side of the football. Seattle continuing to improve. Yes, the Jets are awful on offense, but the fact remains the Seahawks are continuing to get better defensively each week. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Locked On Seahawks podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day. As an avid runner and weightlifter, it's never easy to stay on top of your game. Whether I'm trying to increase my max on bench press or cut my best mile time by 10 seconds, there are always obstacles and you have to find a way to power through them. What is your wall and how do you run through it? For me, I turn to Built Go, the healthy replacement for your energy drink. Coming from the makers of Built Bar, you know it's top quality and delicious. Easy to take in 1.5-ounce packages, it's the best workout gel on the market without the crash feeling you get from products such as 5-Hour Energy because it's all natural with 1/3 of the caffeine of a monster drink. Built Go comes in 3 delicious flavors, including peanut butter honey, chocolate coconut, and chocolate mint. Loaded with the good stuff to help me power to my goals, it includes fast-absorbing collagen protein, beta-alanine, B3, honey, and a kick of caffeine to help me get going and promote joint, soft tissue, hair, and skin health. This stuff literally makes you look better. Visit BuiltGo.com and use promo code LOCKED, and you'll get 30% off your next order. Use promo code LOCKED for 30% off at BuiltGo.com. Let's go. Welcome back to the Locked On Seahawks podcast, Tuesday edition. I'm Corbin Smith, your lead host, joined by Rob Rang. The wait is almost over. The 2020-2021 NBA season is almost here, and the Locked On NBA podcast will get you ready with a special week of shows beginning December 14th. Get previews of every team, division by division, from all 30 of our Locked On local experts, plus waiver wire additions from Locked On Fantasy Basketball, rookies to watch from Chad Ford, and predictions on each division from Rejecting the Screen. Subscribe to Locked On NBA wherever you get podcasts. The Seahawks improved to 9-4 on Sunday. The game was never really in doubt. Seattle built a 23-3 halftime advantage and continued to keep the foot on the pedal in the third quarter, eventually extending the lead to 34 points and winning a 40-3 decision over the Jets, the second biggest win during the Pete Carroll era for Seattle. Everybody's been talking about the offense, understandably so. Russell Wilson got back rolling again with four passing touchdowns. The run game produced over 170 yards, as we mentioned yesterday, but quietly, the defense went out, and this is a Jets offense, as bad as the Jets have been. You mentioned this last week. They had three games in their past five that they scored at least 27 points. The offense had been playing better for the Jets. It didn't matter in this particular game, as the Seahawks gave up a field goal on the first drive. And after that, they, as the game progressed, just got better. The Jets didn't even get past midfield in the second half.
Yeah, it really was a remarkable performance. You know, as you mentioned, this was a Jets offense that was starting to click, you know, and they do have some intriguing talent at the wide receiver position. I remain a fan of Sam Darnold. I still saw some throws against Seattle. I thought, wow, that's why you were a first-round selection. Unfortunately for Jets fans, some of Darnold's best throws wound up slipping through the fingers of either Jets wide receivers or in the couple of times that the Seahawks stepped in front of passes and had a couple of opportunities. But you saw the reason why the Jets are losing, because they just made some critical errors, but you also saw their talent. So to me, kudos to the Seahawks. I mean, anytime that you have a team that is on the ropes and you you know, what Seattle has done so many times is basically played to the level of their competition. They need a get right game, and they certainly did that against the Jets. And to me, the most exciting aspect about it is just how completely they dominated the game. They were better at the line of scrimmage. Their linebackers were making big plays. Their defensive backs were making big plays. It was all over the field. I think that we're going to start highlighting any individual players, that I think that we have to start off with number 33, Jamal Adams, who, of course, with the sack against his former team, now is the all-time sack record, sack holder, among defensive backs in NFL history. A pretty remarkable feat.
To do it in just nine games, too, that's what just makes it all the more remarkable. 8.5 sacks by a safety in nine games. And this is what's crazy, Rob, is the Seahawks have not been sending him on the blitz as much the last couple weeks. He only blitzed five times on Sunday against the Jets. They were dropping him back into coverage quite a bit. And so the people out there are saying, oh, he just blitzes all the time. There have been games where he's blitzed a lot higher frequency, but the last few games he hasn't been. And so the Seahawks are still figuring out how to best utilize him. And for him to go out and get that record, I just want to put in perspective what a start to his career Jamal Adams has had. As a pass rusher, being such a unique talent, he now has 20.5 sacks in his career. He is the only defensive back in NFL history to accomplish that before the age of 29. He, by the way, is just 25 years old. So he blew that record away. He's already seventh on the all-time list. They've been counting sacks officially since 1982. He is tied with Leroy Butler, who many believe belongs in the Hall of Fame, has still not gotten there yet. He is tied for seventh for sacks among defensive backs, and he's just in his fourth NFL season. He has a chance to break that record within the next year, because the record is 30 sacks by Rodney Harrison. He has a chance to potentially break it next season for the Seahawks, and he's just going to be entering the prime of his career. He could truly obliterate this record, and maybe this will be the kind of transcendent playmaker that ultimately changes what teams are looking for at the safety position, given the success that he's having and how dominant he is rushing off the edge, blitzing A and B gaps. I mean, you can send him all over the field, and he's just got an uncanny ability for a guy that's around 210 pounds to get to the quarterback.
He really does. And that's the thing, is it's not just getting to the quarterback. We talked about the sacks, but he's got 9 tackles for loss so far this season as well. So it's just his ability rushing upfield, his ability to kind of be that spy that can slow down the dynamic dual threat quarterbacks, or perhaps, line up against, tight ends, wide receivers, running backs. You know, he has an ability that, is just exceptionally rare in the NFL, because there's a lot of instinctive players out there. There's a lot of athletic players. There's a lot of tough players. He's all three. And so to have a player like that, it just gives Seattle kind of a hidden chess piece, basically, that they can kind of move wherever they want to move him, and they can do all kinds of dynamic things. They basically, because Jamal Adams and his kind of dynamic talent, they can, in a way, play offense on defense, because with Jamal Adams, his ability to create big plays puts the rest of the Seahawks defenders in position to steal the ball as well.
You truly can move him all over the field, and you're starting to see the Seahawks do that defensively. Ken Norton Jr. deserves a lot of credit, because they had some new pieces that they were trying to get mixed in. You had injuries. Adams missed 4 games himself, and now you can see those pieces coming together. And I'm going to mention another guy that joined the team in the middle of the season, and he's a big run stuffer. So Damon Harrison maybe not necessarily getting the attention that he deserves, because this is a passing league, but you aren't going to see very many games where a 350-pound nose tackle dominates the line of scrimmage and makes tackles like Snacks did on Sunday. He finished with a season-high 6 tackles. He also forced a fumble against Frank Gore. And Rob, you and I have been watching Frank Gore play for like 2 decades, and ball security has never been an issue for him. But Damon Harrison punched the football out and forced a fumble. The Seahawks got a field goal a couple plays later off that to extend their lead to 14 points early. But he was extremely disruptive. The Jets were able to get a couple nice runs off tackle, but if they tried to run between the two guards and Damon Harrison was in the game, they weren't getting anything. They were just getting stuffed pretty much every play. And 59 was the reason for that. Easily his best game as a Seahawk. And it's allowing them to do some interesting stuff with Puna Ford. That's one of the reasons Puna Ford is blossoming in year 3. He's able to play more of that 3-tech role, and he's really reaching his potential as a pass rusher. Damon Harrison's allowing him to do that by checking in at the nose tackle and really being a stone wall there.
Yeah, exactly. That's like we were talking about just a moment ago with Jamal Adams, and how his ability to create big plays is basically the rest of the Seahawks defense being able to feed off of that. Same thing with Harrison. I love that you mentioned Puna Ford. I would argue that the first round pick Jordan Brooks, and how he's been able to get freed up and be able to truly use his sideline to sideline speed, it's also been huge for him as well. So lots of exciting things on the Seahawks on the defensive side of the ball. Of course, there were some things that they needed to improve on. There were some opportunities there. Pete Carroll talked about it in the post-game press conference. They really should have had 4 turnovers in this game. The dropped interception by Adams is the one that really jumps out at you, because, my goodness.
Get on the jugs machine, for God's sake. And you know exactly. What? I'm going to give Adams a ton of credit, though, because after the game, when he was talking about the sack record, he immediately said, "I suck," after he was talking about that drop interception. So clearly he was upset that he did not make that play. He expects to make that play. This especially given the fact there's a lot of fans that don't think he can play coverage. Everything up to missing that interception was perfect. He was in robber coverage in front of the free safety, Quandre Diggs. He stepped right in front of that crossing route. He read it perfectly. And really, he set up Sam Darnold, his former teammate, to make that bad throw. And he just didn't finish the play. But of course, he was not alone.
No, he was not alone, unfortunately, for the Seahawks. And that's one of the things, is that anytime you have an opportunity to really step on the throat of an opponent, let me take that. I don't want to say that. Anytime you have an opportunity to really put an opponent away, then you want to be able to, you know, to finish. And that was the thing, is Seattle literally had too many opportunities slipped through their fingers. They had too many opportunities where they had possible sacks that, you know, Darnold, being the dynamic athlete that he is, was able to kind of wiggle his way through, you know, wiggle his way away. So to me, that is, again, if you're going to you know, criticize Seattle's defense, then their inability to finish on a couple of different occasions against the Jets is something that you certainly can improve upon. It's one of the reasons why I'm excited that Seattle could possibly be getting back two absolutely dynamic defenders against Washington. Carlos Dunlap, again, I think is going to be a big time addition, as well as Dunbar. You mentioned it, and I wanted to kind of get back to this point. You mentioned it in the first quarter, Corbin, about that how Dunbar had struggled against Buffalo, and there were so many Seahawks fans who were concerned about that. You look at Washington, they don't have the same kind of straight line speed, and they don't have the same type of deep ball accurate quarterback. So that's one of the reasons why Dunbar coming back in this particular game against Washington, it's not just the coming back and performing against his own team. This is a great game to kind of gauge where he's at before the Rams game, as well as be able to just physically match up against the Washington's receivers on the outside.
Yeah, Washington's got some weapons on the outside, but they don't necessarily have the talent that the Buffalo Bills do. And we've seen Buffalo's receivers really torch a number of good defenses. There's a reason Buffalo is kind of that sleeper right now. Maybe they can take the Chiefs in the playoffs once we get to January football. Going back to what you said of the dropped interceptions, obviously Adams is the one that everybody remembers, but Ugo Amadi had one that went right through his hands, and KJ Wright and Puna Ford both were competing for an interception, and neither one of them ended up coming down with it. There were a couple other opportunities where the ball was in the breadbasket and they weren't able to make a play. So those are ones you go back and you look and say, okay, it didn't cost us in this game because we were in control. But when you're playing a better opponent, you better capitalize when you position yourself to make plays like that so that you can create turnovers. And the missed sacks are certainly something that they can clean up too. I know LJ Collier is probably still kicking himself that Sam Darnold juked him out. And LJ Collier made an incredible move to get into the backfield too. He just couldn't finish. And I don't think fans realize how hard it is now in today's game with the way the rules are to get sacks. And I do think it impacts the way pass rushers approach quarterbacks. There's no question about it. So it does make it easier for quarterbacks to be able to make moves like that and slip away from people. They certainly had a few other opportunities they could have blasted Darnold and weren't able to quite get home. But those are the little things they need to fix to beat the really good football teams. And they're going to be playing a couple of them here in coming weeks. Washington's playing really well. They could be without Alex Smith, though, in this game. If Dwayne Haskins plays, that's an advantage potentially for the Seahawks. And then the week after, obviously, the Rams, a must-win game for the Seahawks if they want to capture an NFC West title. So those little mistakes they made this past weekend, they got to sharpen them up and get to the next level. But certainly, this defense is trending in the right direction. Now giving up less than 300 passing yards per game, thanks to the last five games, really tightening things up in the secondary. The pass rush has gotten home 24 sacks in those five games. They were able to get pressure against the Jets, even without Dunlap being in the lineup. So a lot of very encouraging developments on that side of the football with three games left to play. Make sure to follow me on Twitter at Corbin Smith NFL. You can follow Rob at Rob Rang. Subscribe to our show on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, whatever your preferred podcast platform is, by visiting our website, LockedOnSeahawks.com. Make sure to leave us a review as well. Coming up on tomorrow's episode, it's all about the matchups. On Wednesday, we'll be looking at Seattle versus the Washington football team. They're red hot, four straight wins to climb to the top of the NFC East. They're even almost to 500, which this year in that division is a pretty remarkable accomplishment. This is a well-coached football team. Looking forward to breaking down matchups for the Seahawks on offense and defense heading into this Week 15 contest. Enjoy the rest of your Tuesday. Go Hawks.